Hey, this is Dr. Drew, and you are listening to This Life
with Bob Forrest
and Dr. Drew.
Here we are.
Welcome, everybody. However, today the co-host is Mike Carano sitting in for Bob. He's at Coachella today. He's a musician. You
know, that's a good priority.
No,
I should have worn a hat.
I'd rather have needles poked in my eyes. I must tell you.
Well, I know a guy that can make that happen.
No, thank you. No, thank you. The other voice you're hearing is Kimberlyn Brown Pelzer. She is a candidate for Senate. Excuse me, for a
Congress.
Congressional seat.
Right.
Maybe one day Senate seat.
You never know.
And Kim and I were neighbors 100 years ago. I've known her longer. I've known you, Mike, as you pointed
out. I'm sure a woman appreciates you saying 100 years ago.
Listen, it was a separate lifetime ago. You all know Kim from Bold and Beautiful and Young and the Restless, where she is Sheila.
Right.
And she looks
right.
Sort of an evil character, right, a lot of the time?
She's very evil.
Right.
Very evil. Right.
What a stretch.
You know?
I'm going to take a wild stab in the dark. Your character was evil.
Well, but don't the evil ones sometimes turn good and then they go back to evil?
No, my character's just always been evil. And it's fun. I get paid for that.
Yeah. Well, can I ask you what years you were on?
She's still on.
I'm still on. I'm still under contract to Bold and Beautiful.
Didn't you take a break?
Started in 1991.
Okay. Because I was in that building in 94 through 98.
What
CBS,
building?
Television
okay.
City.
Okay.
CBS.
We maybe had lunch in the commissary at the same time.
We might have.
Wow, it's fantastic.
I don't know. I always went out back to the Grove, so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was cool back then.
Yeah. It's still great. It's still awesome.
It was not even the Grove back then, was it?
Farmer's Market.
No, it's just Farmer's Market.
Yeah, which is still that piece that people know Los Angeles.
And I still love it.
The Brazilian restaurant's still there.
Moshi's is still there?
Yeah, that too.
Fantastic. So what prompted this? What mobilized you?
You know what? I just can't be quiet anymore, Drew. I really can't. I really believe that for the first time in the history of our country, we're not leaving something better to our youth. And you and I,
yeah.
And you, we're going to be part of that generation that leaves something worse than what we inherited.
Well, you know, you can say what you want about Sarah Palin, but I always liked her story. That she was, you know, sitting on the sidelines and a mom watching her kids play hockey and went, you know what? This state's a mess. I should run for governor.
Yeah.
And then did it. I'm like, I forget her politics and put her personality, everything else aside. That story to me is a uniquely American story.
I was going to say, I like stories too. Like Hitler was an aspiring artist.
Go ahead,
I appreciate
Mike.
That.
Go ahead. Thank you for that, buddy. Thank you. I appreciate it. In any event, but your story's kind of like that, though,
trying
right?
To be funny.
I mean, sort of that way. You actually spoke at the Republican National Convention.
I did. You know, I was invited to a forum of 100 businesswomen in Southern California because even though I act, Mike, a lot of people don't know that I put my money to work for me. I employ over 100 people here in the state of California, 180 during our busiest time of year. And I saw what my employees were going through. I saw the struggles and how real they were and how nobody felt like they had a voice.
Mm.
And Drew, I just woke up one morning and said, I'm going to go to this thing for the business women just to listen to Trump to see what he was about, because this was during the primary and I really wasn't sure who I was for at that time. I just knew I wasn't for Hillary.
Mm. And were you always Republican or was that
you know what?
Too?
Grew up Republican. My grandfather used to go on trail rides with Ronald Reagan.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
So it goes way, way back. But I
you listened?
I listened and I got up and I spoke at that event and I talked about the things that affect my employees and affect our businesses. And after that speech that I gave, unbeknownst to me, they started vetting me to speak at the GOP convention. And I spoke there on behalf of small business and women in business.
Crazy. Was it nerve-wracking?
It was the scariest thing I've ever done. I have never been in front of an audience like that in my life.
And
a live audience, I should say. Yeah.
But it's also, that was a major television event, too.
I
know you're on TV, but this
it's
is
different.
A live
it's
thing
different.
Going out everywhere.
And it's a bunch of animals out there, too, right? You're speaking to people that can turn on you really
well,
easily.
You're also
and you're way up high and sort of removed from them, right? It's not like it's a cozy speaking environment.
No, you're up on stage. You're away from them. And it was interesting because when they asked me to speak, they said, oh, you know, we're going to have somebody help you write your speech and so on and so forth. And then I get a phone call from the speechwriter going, everything we find out about you is about your character.
Oh, that's hysterical.
So it's like we're guessing you're not
Kim,
quite
you're such
like
a bitch. What
yeah,
the hell?
Yeah, exactly. You've tried
you
to kill
that
who?
Guy
exactly.
Down the,
exactly.
Down the stairs.
So my husband and I actually wrote our speech, and I think that's why it was so effective because it came from my heart. It wasn't coming from a bunch of kids that were interviewing me and didn't really know me.
Well, a lot of the issues, and this is, you know, this podcast obviously is heard outside of California, but a lot of the stuff your employees, I'm sure, were struggling with were the result of this state's policies, which are just like, I've just looked around this state of California. I have to do a radio show on KBC every day, and I can't, it upsets me how broken down everything is. Forget the policies and the intent. It's just broken down.
Well, it's across the board. It's with the traffic issues. It never stops. I mean,
it's broken down. Like, yeah. I mean, what is government's fundamental responsibility?
I don't know.
Sanitation.
Okay.
Water. Safety.
Yeah.
Let's get a little transportation there. Be nice. And I don't know if people around the country are aware. In Los Angeles, the roads, about the condition they were in about 1890. You can't.
It's not even the condition. It's they don't plan for the future.
And they don't work. The ones that are in good shape don't work.
Yeah.
There's no public transportation.
Yeah, but they are painting them white.
Oh, not only that, they're going to get bike lanes involved so you can narrow the roads down even further and get on a bicycle and go 13 miles to work. It's like ridiculous. It's insane the way they're thinking about the
populace. Yeah, we're spending that money on urban warming.
And then we have people in Southern California and Northern California suffering in the streets, lying in the streets, suffering, and people step. I mean, this is unconscionable.
This is every single day of my life. I see someone sleeping on the sidewalk as a Bentley rolls by.
Have you ever seen it like that in the state of California?
No,
in your lifetime,
never anywhere.
California,
never
born anywhere. And raised, third generation. I know you are, and I've never seen the homeless situation in California.
But here's
like this.
here's the rub. Mm-hmm. So Santa Ana, there's a place in Orange County called Santa Ana River where there was 700 of them or something. They cleared them out. They pulled out 45,000 pounds of feces and 15,000 needles. Yeah. Those are the ones they could find. Right. The other needles you're going to walk, you're going to swim into in the ocean should you go out.
Somebody
there.
Is,
but right,
I'm not going anywhere.
So LA has the same thing with these dumps on either side of the encampments. The encampments are everywhere in Los Angeles. There's everywhere.
They're on Melrose right now.
Yeah.
Okay, so there
they're
are dumps.
Beverly Boulevard.
There are dumps on either side, feces and debris and what else, and the rats outnumber the humans about at least 10 to 1, maybe 100 to 1. Those rats in this part of the country carry rickettsial disease. There's going to be a major public health infectious disease outbreak in Southern California. Norovirus, you know, in the summer, that volatilizes. You can walk by that and you breathe it. You got it. So there is a major, major thing coming this summer. And government is doing – and the media, and there are people suffering at the same time.
Yeah.
And the entire populace is put at risk. This is government.
No, but you know what? It's the rules and the regulations that they're passing in Sacramento that's creating the problem, though, Drew. I mean, when you pass laws that state that we no longer uphold vagrant laws, it's insanity. And then when they pass new laws like they have now saying that if you can steal something, as long as it's less than $1,000, what is the number? I think it's 900 and change. It's no longer a crime, it's a ticket.
But what is
and
this leading to? Anarchy?
Well, what is that?
What is that? What I don't get. What's the
it's unbelievable. So what that has done is it has opened up California for all of these homeless people that are flocking here because they can steal now as long as it's less than $1,000 and get away with it and survive in the street because of it.
To me, that's blaming the homeless a little bit.
No. It's other states as well, though, because when I go to visit Alexis in Arizona, and my daughter in Arizona, they are coming to the border there in California,
of course,
and the police are there to help get them to the border in California.
But you've got a balance here between being compassionate and caring about other people and then wanting to clean up, because you can't say get them off the street and not have a solution.
This drives me insane. There is
my stupidity or
no,
the whole
fact
question?
The fact that the way the press covers it is so false.
Right.
There are adequate resources. The problem is when you have mental health issues and are chronically homeless like this, these kinds of mental health issues create lack of insight, resistance, and lack of trust. And it takes quite a bit of energy and skill to get them enrolled. It's not a housing problem. It's a mental health crisis. And for whatever reason, the politicians keep championing this idea that that's a housing problem, which is certainly a piece of the story. But you can't. They won't go. I have a woman right now I'm working with for a week. I've got a place for. I've got mental health services. I have a social worker. No. And you can't force that. And it takes all this skill to get people in. That's what's hard.
And then you've got a lot of people, though, Drew, like you're talking about, with mental health issues that don't realize there's the help out there for them.
But
still,
no, they don't want it. That's part of the deal. It's part of, but because if you're a heroin addict on the street, and you don't want it, so you have to be able to push it motivate it. You have to motivate the treatment. You can't do that now.
So how do we prioritize what's important for government to do, and how do we how do we push people to do that, like a government, like yourself?
Well, you know, I wish that the office I was running for, you know, had issues that could actually deal with state issues. California has set themselves up for this. And, you know, everyone goes into government, I believe, with the best of intentions. But you've got to look at it like a business. If I make a business decision that's bad for my company and it's going to cost me my business, I make changes to fix the problem. We have too many people in office that create rules, regulations, and they know that they don't work, and yet they don't want their name attached to something that has failed. Mm-hmm. They've got to get over that.
It's just human nature, though.
It's human nature. You don't want any. Oh, it wasn't my fault, and I get that. But you know what? We need good people that are willing to step up for the state of California and call a spade a spade. Say, this is the problem. This is what we need to try and do something to fix it. And it's not just a state issue. I mean, when you look at the gun violence and things like that, there are laws in place already. They're simply not being adhered to. So why do we pass laws? Why do we pass laws if we're not gonna abide by them anyway? Why do we pass regulations if we're not gonna type that name of that horribly ill person into a base that all government agencies can draw from? Those are already set up. They're already in place. We're not using them, Mike.
Yeah, I also got to say, from a, I don't know if it's a spiritual standpoint, but just from an ethical in my own head, it's very disheartening for me to just disagree people on the street.
I can't stand
and then be concerned about, I need more money. I need to do this. Yeah. I need more success.
If I were a government official, if I were the mayor or the city council is starting to get it together a little bit, and as are the county supervisors. But if I were one of those people, I wouldn't sleep at night. I'd be frantic trying to solve that problem. I don't understand how they could just let it be.
Yeah. And you should see it out in the Coachella Valley as well. I mean, I drove recently out to the Salton Sea to show somebody the Salton Sea and the tent cities all along the freeway going out to Coachella.
I've been to Salton Sea 15 times.
It's heartbreaking.
Why were you out there?
I'm obsessed with places that are run down, and I don't know if it's a perverse sort of...
Yes, it
like
is.
I'm fascinated with
it,
but
it's perverse.
It's also a weird reminder that everything is temporary, because you look at all those what used to be resorts in the 50s, and now they're falling into the water, and the people that live around the peripheral are in such financially bad
It used to be an amazing place in its heyday. It used to be one of the number one places for people to go.
Really?
Yes.
But I've been to Slab City many, many times.
What is it?
It scares the shit out of
me,
frankly.
What is Slab City?
Yeah. Slab City was an old military compound, and they removed all the buildings, left all the slabs for the buildings were, and people just moved in. So there's between 500 and thousands of residents at certain times of the year, but there's people that live there full-time with no running water, no electricity. Huh. And they are permanent residents. I've driven around there and photographed there and stuff, and there are just, you know, they throw a trailer down, put a wall around it, and it's kind of, there's a sign that says last lawless place in California. I know that's not true, but realistically, if something were to go down in Slab City, when are the cops getting there? A half an hour, 2 hours, maybe never?
Out there.
Would that be part of your district?
Well, Salton Sea, the northern part of Salton Sea definitely is. Yeah, and my family's actually owned property out there since the 40s in Coolidge Springs. And the fun little piece of history, that's where Patton used to train his troops for their desert warfare.
He knew that.
I think Salton Sea.
He's been there a lot.
Salton Sea is fascinating, but it's exactly what you think if you're a pessimist when you go there, because I was in Bombay Beach 3 weeks ago.
What's Bombay Beach?
It's one of the cities in Salton Sea.
All I know about Salton Sea, I fly over it in the way I look.
Yeah. It looks beautiful.
It looks desolate from this air.
But I walked the streets with a camera for about an hour and a half with a person I just met right then, and two people volunteered to me, we can't put solar panels out because the meth heads will steal it. And I was like, why would two people just volunteer that? So you know what it is. And it's the kind of place, if I were a meth head, I'd be like, I could literally buy a piece of property with a trailer for $2,500, $3,500, and live there.
But you know what's really interesting is if you go out there, if you look at the money that was paid for the infrastructure,
I mean,
roads, curbs, sidewalks, slabs, everything else. Those were all taxpayer dollars that were put into the infrastructure there, and it's just been walked away from. Absolutely walked away from.
But there is a reason it was walked away from.
And what's the reason?
It's that smell.
Okay, well, that's another issue, though. You know, I've been to D.C. a few times now, obviously, since I'm running for office, and I was able to meet with the head of the Water Commission here in the state of California, and for a quarter of the cost of building that bullet train that is already billions over budget.
You could do anything. You could go to the moon.
But for a quarter of the cost, we'd have 10 new reservoirs in the state of California and fix the salt and sea issue, which means that we would have solved our water issues in the state of California for generations to come.
What is the salt and sea issue?
The salt and sea issue is it's evaporated, and by the evaporation, the salinity has gone up. As a matter of fact, tilapia isn't expected to live in the lake after 2018. Mm. That's how bad it is.
Well, don't they have?
But they used to funnel fresh water to the lake, and they're not doing that any longer.
Don't they have huge incidents of botulism every year when it gets hot and?
Botulism.
Hundreds of thousands of birds die and wash up onto the shores.
Well,
and fish
you know what? What they're looking to do right now. Interesting enough, Gavin Newsom was out there, and they put a big, you know, story in the paper, and he's showing some interest in it. But I've got to tell you what, we have politicians that show interest in it every election year. I can tell you, if it was in Pelosi's backyard, it never would be where it's at today. There's already been money allocated to do the bird sanctuaries. And they haven't even tapped into that. So they have on the books, initiatives to do bird sanctuaries and to funnel X amount of gallons of water into the lake. Our biggest problem out there right now, and those communities that you walked around and you saw, they're very poor now, Drew.
Oh, sure.
Where it used to be a thriving, resort area. It's now because the evaporation is so bad, and the lake has so much runoff from farming industry, not only from the Coachella Valley, but also from Imperial Valley and all the rest, that now we've got toxic dust because of the water level going so low that the incidence of serious respiratory problems amongst the young kids that are growing up out by the Salton Sea, which is mainly Latino, now is mainly Latino, is unbelievable, and nobody wants to address the problem.
But what about when that smell starts coming into Palm Springs? Won't people address it then?
Well, on a good windy day, it might be able to hit Palm Springs, but I've lived there, and I've never witnessed it.
On a side note, does that guy that owns Robo Lights drive you crazy?
Robo Lights.
What is Robo Lights?
You're not familiar with Robo Lights?
I'm not.
Oh my God!
Is that like the jerky king?
I don't even know
Vegas
where to begin on this. It's in a very nice neighborhood in Palm Springs, not too far from the Strip.
Robo Lights.
He owns four lots that are all connected, and he constructed a giant, super creepy Disneyland style carnival out of trash, and it's all painted garish colors. I thought it was fascinating, but overall, it's hyper creepy.
It's called Robo.
And it is,
Robo Lights. Guess where I'm stopping on the way home.
It is. You're going to be. If you are not familiar with it, you will be in shock.
Why is it called Robo Lights?
There's a lot of robots in there. There's 2 and 3 story robots, and they move, and it's loud, and it is
music?
Just.
And it's right in the heart of Palm Springs.
I flew the drone over it. It's
how
dark.
How could I miss this?
Darkness, darkness, darkness.
How far is it from Lulu's?
wait a minute. Is it only when at night that it operates?
Christmas time, but it's there year round.
Oh, Christmas.
Okay. And the first time I was there, I hate to be this guy because I'm not this guy, but I guess I am.
Yeah.
The first thing I thought was, if I owned a house here, I would hate.
Well, of course you
that
would.
Guy because there are thousands of people coming there.
No, I
every night during Christmas time.
But you can still see it now.
Yeah. Oh, there's no way to miss it.
Oh, my God.
There's giant pink, blue, and green.
The Christmas parade was amazing, though.
It's all made of trash. And it is just, it's nuts.
All right, let's get off the sidebar. I want to give Kim a chance to talk about her district. Now, this is Sonny Bono's position, who Mary Bono then took over for a while.
Exactly.
She's now in Washington doing other things.
Right.
I imagine you were fans of theirs.
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, I knew Sonny when he had Bono's on La Cienega Melrose.
Oh, yeah.
Remember when that was there? At that time, he wasn't married to Mary. He was married to Susie Quillo. But, then he moved out to the desert like so many Hollywood people really, really do these days. I'll tell you what, there's a huge, huge group of of people living out there that commute into LA for work now. But the seat, unfortunately, was lost. And a doctor actually won the seat, Dr. Raul Ruiz. And, you know, great American story. Born in Mexico. His dad was a worker in the fields in Coachella, brought his family up here. The farmer that his dad worked for actually put him through Harvard Medical School. Mm. But the deal that he made was, I'm going to put you through school, but you need to promise me you're going to stay here and practice medicine in the Coachella Valley because we don't have enough doctors. And that was the deal that was made, and he broke that deal 2 years after graduating from college.
He moved somewhere else.
He ran for office.
Oh, so he's been in office. I'm confused. He never practiced medicine?
He was an ER doctor.
Okay.
For 2 years.
Got it. And then he did other things.
And then he went on to represent our district, and he's been incredibly ineffective and a Pelosi yes man all the way. And what really scares me about that is the fact that Pelosi has publicly even stated that at first it was, you know, we're going to impeach the president, and now it's we're going to repeal the tax cuts. Now, I know that might make a few people in California happy that have their million-plus home, but I'll tell you what, the tax cuts have done nothing but help business all across the United States. It's not just a California issue. It's an issue all across the United States where you can expense now within the first year instead of 7 years. People are actually reinvesting in their companies, and people who had to put off buying equipment before, they don't have to put it off anymore. Even for our business in San Diego, one of them that we have is a boating and marina operation where normally we would buy 6 jet skis for each location every year. We're buying 10 now because we can expense it. And it's really part of the reason you see this economy kicking up as fast as you have, because people now have the money to invest in their companies. You know, you were asking earlier, why am I running? This is another reason why. Because
you want to preserve these jobs.
Preserve these jobs. I have my finger on the pulse of business. I absolutely know what they're going through and what the rules and regulations are doing to affect them.
Can I ask you about your avocado farm?
Yeah.
Before you do, I think, do we have to take a break soon? Are we?
5 more minutes.
Okay. Avocado farm.
Okay. Avocado farm.
Yeah. Like, how is there a benefit to having grown in California avocados? And
as opposed to what?
Is that a marketing benefit?
Because
I see avocados that came from Chile, maybe not Chile, but there were
somewhere.
I noticed on one of the avocados.
They do have them from Chile. They have them from Mexico. They have them from everywhere around the world. You know, that's one of the things that NAFTA did. It opened up our borders for people to farm elsewhere and not farm by the same standards that we're held to here in the United States. For instance, when it's time for me to pick my fruit, that's usually when Mexico floods the border, driving the pricing down for your American farmer. And it's not just avocados in the Coachella Valley. It's grapes. It's all of that. But a lot of your California farmers have also purchased properties now and are farming in Mexico because it's so much cheaper to do
because
so.
Because the labor's cheaper and the land is cheaper?
Both. And they
don't. What about the fertility of the soil? Is it exactly the same or does it matter?
It's not the same. It's absolutely not the same. You can get away with things in other countries that you can't get away with here in the United States. And that's got to change as well.
You're talking about dumping chemicals. You're talking about putting chemicals in the ground
and all the rest. Yeah. Using water that's not clean. And that's why when you taste a beautiful Haas avocado from Fallbrook or Temecula, the flavor is so much better than anything you're getting from Mexico.
Are avocados seasonal?
They are. They are. Haas avocados are seasonal, and then you can do 4 days during the winter months.
Is the biggest cost to your farm water?
You know, the biggest cost to most farms is water. For me, I have my own well.
So, oh, holy smokes.
Yeah. I'm one of those people that were blessed to do that. The small mom-and-pop farms all around the one that I own, that my husband and I own, they're cutting down their groves because they can't afford. For one thing, the market being driven down so much so that you can't afford the water and you can't afford the labor. It's amazing. Last year, after Trump was elected, it was the first time our prices went up on our avocados in 7 years. And they're up again this year.
Is it like a market price?
It's, you know what he's doing? He's stopping trucks at the border and looking for drugs. And if that truck has drugs on board, he's stopping the truck behind that as well. and it goes on and on and on. It used to be they only stopped 2% of the trucks coming across the border, and lo and behold, 2% of those trucks had drugs on board. Well, if you do the math, that's 100%. Am I right?
2% of the trucks have drugs on board?
Yeah. Well, that's all. No,
you thought it'd be more?
That's all they were allowed to stop. Those are only the ones they were allowed to stop. So now they're stopping more, and it's actually helped out the avocado industry because those trucks are lined up.
So there's this really interesting diet out there, the lectin-free diet, that's going to push avocados up a bit, I think, in terms of popularity.
I don't even know what lectin is.
It's an interesting story. This one physician is advocating it, and it's helping people, it looks like.
Yeah. It's a healthy fat.
The gluten story is only part of the story. It turns out the lectins are these things in many other vegetables and obviously in starches and things like that. And
right.
It's possibly immunologically active, and it's possible that it's creating some of the autoimmune and sort of unpleasant illnesses we have today.
If you could somehow get out of your head and not take outside influence, doesn't your body crave what you need?
No. My body craves chocolate cake.
I was just going to say.
What's the matter with you? Your body craves alcohol.
Okay, that was a terrible question, but I just assumed. I love avocados.
Yeah, me too.
But I mean, is it because I'm crave? It's not just the flavor. It's my body wants something that's
in
that.
Wants something that's in that?
Nah.
No, I don't think so? No, because I'm right there with you with my Breyers gelato with caramel. Yeah.
Why are avocados hit and miss?
Hit and miss. I don't know. I've never had a miss.
Like I buy avocados.
Sometimes
I'll get a bag of avocados at Costco and they're perfect. Then I get another bag and there's two duds in there.
What do you mean duds? What does that mean?
Like black, they're either dark, spoiled, black, or they're just not as good as the other ones. And I don't know why that is.
Well, you know, when you're shopping for your avocados at the store, though, make sure that the stem is still on there, even if it's trimmed down to the lowest. Once the stem is popped, that's when they start ripening away.
Oh, yeah. I had no idea.
I had no idea either.
Yeah, no idea.
That's good information.
Best, just cut them open, pop that seed, a little salt and pepper, a little balsamic drizzle. You're good to go with a spoon.
So I'm assuming a lot of your employees at the avocado farm are Hispanic.
Yes, they are.
And how does that tie into your being a Republican? And I'm just curious if there's a – obviously, I don't mean a contradiction, but I mean
– Let me just say something. I'm sort of libertarian, so I get to look at everybody and hate everybody and like everybody. I get to do both.
Yeah.
But nobody wants anything other than all boats to rise. This idea that somebody wants something and the other person wants to take it away from the other, that is some heavy bullshit.
I wasn't going there with that. But just listen.
I want to state this. Everybody that I know that is a human being that is interested in business or interested in government, they want everybody to rise. They want what the vehement problems are around how we get there, and why there has to be such weird sort of
There's so much violent disagreement.
Yeah, well, is bizarre to me. And then you have to accuse people of not wanting other ships to rise. No, you want everybody to get better. How you do that? Government generally has not been the way to do that. Generally speaking, it's been free markets that have done that for people.
Absolutely.
That's all I'd say.
Yeah.
So.
No, you know what? But it's interesting because you bring a Latino flair into that, and me being a Republican, how does that affect me? You know, I don't label people. I have people, really good people, that work for me. It's like if I have a gay friend of mine that I work with, if he's sitting here, I'm not going to introduce him. Hey, Mike, I want you to meet my gay friend so-and-so. And I'm not going to say, hey, Mike, I want you to meet my African-American aunt. I'm not going to say, hey, Mike, I want you to meet my Latino worker. I see where you're going with it. No,
because
everyone that works for me is legal.
Yeah.
And I make sure of that. And I hire grove managers that have papers on everybody because I truly believe that you have to come here the right way.
But there's
really
also
believe that.
In your district, there's probably a lot of illegals, just like there is in San Diego and where I live and
probably.
You know, all the places I've lived.
Probably.
And I'm in agreement with you. I think people should have to come here the right way, but do you feel like it's more of an uphill climb for you because you are a Republican and some people's perception is Republicans just want to build a wall and keep people out.
Yeah, and you know what? When you talk about that wall, everybody, equates that wall to illegal immigration, and
they equate it to racism.
Well, that's what they've done. That's what the press has put out there. That's what the liberal media. They need to keep the noise. They need
but
to
just
keep
look, look at this logic,
yeah,
Mike.
Off the
when
ball.
When I drive through San Diego on the 5 freeway, right, and I get to the border of Mexico, what am I running into there? What's that thing I run into? I'm waiting in the car, line of cars with.
Yes.
What is that?
That's a wall.
That's a wall. Yeah. You're kidding. It's a wall. And so the Mexican officials on the other side with the machine guns, they're there because they hate me and they're racist. Oh, no. Is that what it is? Those guys with the machine guns, they hate me and they want their wall. And wait a minute. And should that wall go to the ocean? It goes to the ocean on one side.
That's not what I was saying.
But,
I was
is so bizarre to me. How far does it go on the land side? A mile? 10 miles? 1,000?
A
wall.
No, but you know,
it's so bizarre
that we think
of that.
But what he's saying, Drew, is really pretty true. I mean, when you look at how the liberal media and how our liberal politicians, they make it about hate, and they make it about Republicans. They make that wall about Republicans. Well, let me tell you this. Berkeley, one of the most liberal colleges in the United States, just did a recent poll on sanctuary states and cities. And 77% of Californians don't want sanctuary cities, sanctuary states. 4% of Latinos did not want sanctuary cities, sanctuary states.
No, they're harmed by this.
64%+ of Democrats don't want sanctuary cities and sanctuary states. We already have visas that acknowledge the problems of these people that are afraid to come out of the dark to help the police with these prosecutions and such. But nobody even knows about the T visa and the U visa. They don't even know about them. Where if they come forward and they help the police.
I just think they've taken people and they've
separation.
They've politicized something that should be managed. And they're using it to create power and political sort of
capital. But it's creating,
capital,
it's
and that
creating
drives me crazy.
A lot of discontent
it's again, but it's
people.
Again people suffering as a result.
Yeah.
It drives me
but
crazy.
But I think what you just said is that's a serious issue right there. Because if there's a crime that happens in a poor part of town with a lot of Hispanics, maybe a bunch of them are – just say, hypothetically, let's say there a lot of people didn't come here legally.
Okay.
They're not going to help the cops. Because they don't want to get divorced.
Well, but then
that's a real issue that affects everybody.
But the cops tell you that doesn't matter so much because no one's allowed to ask about people's immigration status.
We're not allowed to ask anymore.
I'm not even talking about asking. I'm saying the problem is
here's
they're
the problem.
Not going to help.
No, here's the problem.
Other people, like if I get robbed, they're not going to testify against somebody because they don't want to get.
But Mike, the problem is that guy goes back into their community.
Yeah,
that's the problem. So they're getting harmed.
But
this.
What Mike's talking about is the person actually that's willing to come forward, Drew. Mm. And the thing is they don't know about the T and the U visas, and those visas provide those people with a 3-year. It's a 4-year visa if they help prosecute a case. And they automatically get that visa, and so does their immediate family. And after 3 years, they can actually apply for legal citizenship in our country.
See, that to me is – we need solutions like that. We need to get everybody naturalized. Let's get them all
in. But we have those on the books, Drew, and it's like what you were talking about earlier. And with mental health and all the rest, we have certain things in place. We simply don't put them into use. Into action.
I feel so dumb because I am super gullible.
You're falling for the political, the people that are using these stories.
I just feel
to
like a dumb
power.
Guy that's being played by, and I'm not just talking about Republicans or Democrats, by both sides constantly.
Yes,
and
absolutely.
I can hear something and it gets in
sides.
My head and then it eats away at me.
Yeah.
But
stand in the middle with me. It's wonderful.
You're in the middle.
I'm libertarian. I hate everybody. I hate them all. I don't hate Kim. But it's easy for me. I just really am just like, ugh.
But you're talking about that wall, and they want to make it about immigration, but they don't talk about the human trafficking. They don't talk about the drugs. They don't talk about any of that. I mean, you've got these kids marching on Washington because of the gun violence, and I appreciate them using their voices and coming forward and doing what they feel that they need to do. But where are the kids down on the border holding up pictures, literally photographs, of their friends that are already dead, their friends that are addicted because of the drugs coming across the border? I can tell you my daughter is 24 years old. And she wouldn't be able to have enough hands to hold up her friends that she's lost since high school. She's lost 10 friends. She's 24 years old. 10 friends that never even saw the age of 21.
Yeah.
I'm going to argue my profession probably got them going. So there's a dual prong issue with that.
Yeah, but you know what, Drew? We need to start addressing this as well because this affects everyone.
Read the book Dreamland. I think it'll help you. You read it?
I have that book and I've read it.
Okay, good. Because that really gives you that story.
I'll tell you
what. It's accurate, 100%.
It is scary, accurate.
I'm going to have Sam. I'm going to interview him probably on the Dr. Drew podcast. But he lives in South Pasadena.
I know. Okay, so here's the thing with Dreamland. Yeah. I was handed that book. I actually went to New Hampshire to help walk precincts for Kelly Ayotte because her big thing is getting rid of the drug problem in New Hampshire. When you figure that that's the number one problem in New Hampshire, and it is hundreds and hundreds of miles away from our border, and yet Dreamland was the book handed to me to read on the plane there
I can tell you, having been working in this field for 20-30 years, everything he got, he nailed it. That's exactly the way it all evolved,
both on
the doctor side and on the drug
side. Does he nail a solution?
He doesn't really get. He's a journalist. Listen, I get overwhelmed when I think about the solution. The opioid prescribing by physicians is dropping precipitously
because of the legal issues that are coming up.
Yes. Well, yes, that and finally awareness, too.
Awareness.
But the heroin thing is still running out of control. We're going to talk a little bit about that, are we not?
Yes. In the next segment with the doctor from Hazleton.
Exactly. So there's a perfect place to stop. We'll take a little break. Kimberlyn Brown, Kimberlyn Brown Peltzer, is the Sheila Carter, where she has been called one of the all-time great soap supervillains. This is hysterical. This is hysterical. She is running.
I would be proud of that.
She is running for the 36th District. Is there a website or anything you want to refer people to while we're just.
Absolutely. Yeah. Go to KimberlynForCongress.com.
Perfect. All right. Yeah. We'll take a little break. Be right back.
Thanks.
I want to mention our friends at Bergamot Sport, a supplement that provides all the cardiovascular benefits of the original bergamot, but with additional additives designed to aid athletes and those with active lifestyles. Bergamot Sport is recommended and used by professional and college athletes throughout the world, helps them improve stamina, reduce recovery time, and muscle inflammation. Bergamot Sport is informed sport certified, so athletes can feel confident that it's all natural and it has been banned substance tested. But even if you're not a pro athlete or just getting a workout once a week or so, Bergamot Sport is still worth a try. It can help you work out harder, recover easier, without worrying about being sore or tired the next day. I've used the products myself. I've recommended them to patients. We use them in our family. And I've done so just as physicians and cardiologists around the world have done. And Bergamot Plus is excellent for what's called non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, which has just passed all other forms of liver disease in terms of causing cirrhosis. So it's something that is a major health issue presently and needs to be paid attention to. For a limited time, our listeners can save 10% on their order by entering code DRDREW at checkout. That is DRDREW, all one word. Try Bergamot Sport for yourself. Visit bergamot.com, that is BERGAMET.com, or just click the Bergamot banner at drdrew.com. All right, we're back. We're still here with Kimberlyn Brown Peltzer, and now we're joined by Dr. Joseph Lee. He is a medical director at Hazleton Betty Ford. Dr. Lee, Kimberlyn is running for Congress in your district there, so that's the connection with you guys.
Yes.
Dr. Lee is a psychiatrist, also board certified in addiction medicine. He's written a book, Recovering My Kid, Parenting Young Adults in Treatment and Beyond. Check that out. Dr. Lee, welcome.
Thanks for having me on.
So we were, just before you came out, we were starting to talk about the opioid issues, and we were touting a book called Dreamland, which really chronicles exactly how our profession went off the rail with oral opioids and pain medication. And then the heroin distribution and how, it was actually one city in Mexico that was the major source of all the individual entrepreneurs that came up here and distributed the heroin all over the place.
When you say your profession went off the rails, was that was an unintentional or lacking in knowledge, right?
Well, okay. Dr. Lee, maybe we should start with that because I lived through that horrible couple decades. How do you see that when pain became the fifth vital sign?
Yeah, well, pain did become the fifth vital sign, and things started to really go off the rail at that stage. But I think historically there were a number of other factors that people tend to discount. This happened long before pain as a fifth vital sign. And long before pharmaceutical company involvement, we had a medical system that stigmatized mental health and addiction issues for a while. So if a problem like this were to happen, there was no way the system would have caught it or knew how to address it. So that was an issue. And then there were also other issues with disparity, meaning while the number of deaths have skyrocketed for decades, people have been disenfranchised, and disenfranchised people have been struggling with opioid addiction and heroin for decades. We just didn't pay attention until, you know, white kids in the suburbs started to pass away. So yes, the pain as a fifth vital sign and the pharmaceutical company involvement and what's depicted in Dreamland is certainly a modern historical version of what happened. But I would say there were infrastructure pieces missing all the way along that were exposed as well.
Meaning, because, again, I practiced addiction medicine for 35 years, and there was a glory era in the 80s where you could get anybody in any socioeconomic bracket, and you could treat them, and you could treat them thoroughly. So I'm not quite sure what then the insurance companies kicked in and said, what's the evidence here? Everyone has to be out in 3 days as opposed to 60 days, which is what was sort of routinely the case back then. So I'm not quite sure what infrastructure part you're talking about.
Well, I'm just talking about the global disparity about mental health and addiction issues. And so, you know, you may have practiced at a time before HMOs, but I think that's when I grew up. And so that's been around now for, you know, 3-4 decades now. And that was the reality growing up for me in medical training. And even prior to that, a parent takes a young person who has mental health issues or addiction issues into a fancy hospital in a nice atrium, and they're often shipped to the back annex building, which isn't as nice if they have addiction or mental health issues. And so I think when insurance companies started to get more involved, the trend of stigma definitely started to increase, and there was less payment in the system, less money and talent in the system. And I think that slide has been going on, had been going on probably for a couple of decades prior to pain as a fifth vital sign.
You see, I must have started practicing in a glory era where psychiatric hospitals were very posh. Psychiatrists were thought of in high esteem. We'd been through the era of sort of stigmatization of mental health, and it was already becoming understood that this was a brain problem, and it was the decade of the brain, if you remember, was the 90s, and that was all, you know, things looked really positive. And you're right, the insurance companies were restricted it all down. We couldn't even do our job.
When you say stigmatized, are you talking about how I know terms like loony bin and stuff like that?
Yeah, mental health's always been stigma. Look, the I have to give a lecture on stigma in a couple of weeks, but the idea is stigma has many different sort of incarnations, but fundamentally it's making somebody other, keeping them down, keeping them out. And it's based on, as much as anything, ignorance and fear and other sorts of tribal kinds of instincts that humans naturally have, frankly. Dr. Lee, do you agree with that?
Yeah, and the footprints of that stigma are everywhere, and it's financially related. That's one way to track it. If you look at any hospital, you know, the divisions that make money are procedural, and so they're not mental health and addiction driven, and that's also influenced by insurance companies. And so if you just kind of follow the money trail of which practices got preferred, even the kind of a mill kind of culture that medicine has turned into that also tends to dehumanize in some aspects and makes it difficult to treat addiction and mental health. So if you kind of follow the money priority trail, the footprints of stigma are everywhere.
That is 100% true.
Could money solve this problem?
I think personally, I think innovation needs to. Well, first, go ahead, Dr. Lee, because there's a lot of answers to that question. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I think necessary, but not sufficient, you know? So, yeah. I mean, as a metaphor, you know, you can look at the DC public school system. They spend a lot per capita, you know, per student, but they don't sometimes get the results they're looking for. It's not just money, but I think funding from everything for research to getting talented people in, to thinking differently about how we pay for healthcare. We really went largely into a procedure driven business, and then everybody else became a mill. And I think that really accelerated the stigma, perhaps in inadvertent ways, but I think now we're working back. So for example, when you're talking about the opioid crisis, one of the things that we know works are, you know, health homes and case management and coaching, where people outside of any kind of CPT billing code in an office arranges, coordinates care, talks to family members, really does holistic practice. But in our procedure driven world, that kind of stuff is nonsense. It makes no sense, and there's no way to get reimbursed for that kind of stuff.
You're so right.
And
you
so
have no idea.
The lingering aspects of stigma are still present.
Hang on a second. I don't know if you're aware, Dr. Lee, but John Kelly out of Harvard and Heath Humphreys up at Stanford are about to publish a Cochrane review that will show that a free service does as well or better than a lot of the fancy services we provide. And I'm talking about mutual aid societies, that we need to push very hard on other levels of efficiency of care that we can provide.
I understand.
So I think innovation, Mike, to answer your question,
that's
from my
perspective.
Because
the money isn't there, though, right?
There's no money for that. But
like,
if he
had an endless supply of money to open a 10,000, that's what I'm asking.
Because, first of all, there's a lot of reasons why not. But you know addicts, they you know, but forcing them into treatment.
Facility, if his facility, if he could open 10,000 rooms and hire the best people in the world
it would
to
help.
Work there.
It would help.
Would that be a cure-all for anybody that wanted to ship someone there?
It would help. The shipping someone there.
Yeah, but there's some real world examples there. And we've done research with John Kelly about AA and other things. And so we're proud to know him and have partnered with him before. I've had conversations with him about treatment. And I think philosophically we're aligned there. But if you look at, say, a state funded treatment system and they're doing like an outpatient clinic, well, their resources are really tight. And what that means is on the research angle and the white ivory tower of academia, they want them to do cognitive behavioral therapy and motivational interviewing training, contingency management, medications. But that costs money to train. And you have these poorly resourced outfits that are trying to adopt practice. And then a lot of academics are like, people are resistant towards adopting evidence-based practice.
Yep.
That's not true. There
That's
just isn't
right.
money in the infrastructure do research and development.
You are singing the right tune, man.
You know what, though? You mentioned something earlier, Drew, as far as, you know, the treatment programs used to be a 60-day program.
Yeah.
What does insurance cover today? It's
three days if you're lucky.
Three
and mostly
days if
outpatient,
you're lucky.
If no inpatient. And, I used to just – I had some of those crazy conversations in the world when the HMO started coming in and the restricted services. It was just crazy. You know, I had one point where I said to a guy, a physician reviewer administrator, and I said, look, you know, you keep sending these alcoholics in. You require them to be out in 2 days. It's demoralizing my staff. You name your price, and I will deploy my staff and treat them for as long as it's necessary to get a good out, you know, to properly treat this person.
Right.
And he went, no, I just want a 2-day detox. And I went, that's crazy. He goes,
yeah, I want a 1-day work week.
Here's the answer. He goes, he said these words to me. I'll never forget them. He said, look, if they go out and they drink again, of course they will. But if they do that 3 times, then they'll lose their job. Then they're no longer my concern.
Oh, my gosh.
I'm as a doctor telling him this. It was stunning.
Can you tell me a number?
Stunning.
Can you tell me a number between 60-day rehab and a 3-day rehab? What are the like success results where it will stick?
3 days, zero, unless you follow with a lot of other things. It doesn't have to be inpatient, you know, comprehensive care.
Is there something about 2 months that shifts your brain?
Yes, somewhat, and it depends on the drug, and it depends on what else is going on with that individual. But, you know, I like 6 months. 2 months, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
but you know what people aren't looking at, though, in that three-day thing? You know, I know somebody who works at a treatment center in the desert, and he works with high school kids primarily, and his big thing is keeping these kids alive.
Well, okay. So that's where I wanted to go next. So, Dr. Lee, let's talk a little bit about fentanyl. Fentanyl is one of the big threats, particularly the kids that are using heroin.
Yeah.
Why don't you go ahead and tell us a little bit about it, Dr. Lee?
Yeah, you know, there are a lot of scary statistics out there right now, and I rely on research papers like everybody else, but, you know, they're kind of like looking at a light in the sky, meaning they kind of lag in time, and my best barometer has been just the privilege of seeing kids across the country, and so unfortunately, I've kind of become an expert on drug dealing, because these kids tell me all these stories about the price of heroin in Alaska and where they're getting fentanyl from. So I started to notice a real uptick around late 2014. And I started to notice that some of these kids were going on the dark web, and the dark web had been out there for a while and people were obtaining drugs, but no one trusts anyone on the dark web. But then Bitcoin came around and it became a real catalyst, because Bitcoin allowed you to basically safely launder your money so you could buy these drugs, and then they'd come. And so these kids would tell me that they would buy fentanyl powder. And of course they'd have to be very careful with it, and they wear gas masks and put it in special rooms, and they put little bits of it into water bottles to take it to school. And they distributed it around. And that's when I started to first notice it. But then it started to go in other places. We've known that people have cut heroin with many different things. So when oxycodone became less available in the black market, because it was a dollar a milligram and really expensive anyway, heroin came in its place. Then as that market boomed, things became competitive. And people were cutting all kinds of different powders into heroin to maximize profit, which is, you know, not unnatural for the black market. And fentanyl became one of those things. And at first I was like, you know, hospital grade fentanyl is kind of hard to get. So I wonder why they're doing it. They can't be making money. But then I started to hear these stories of people getting them from these clandestine labs in various ways. And now it's become a huge epidemic, and fentanyl is everywhere. And a lot of people taking fentanyl are taking it inadvertently. They don't know what they're taking.
Yeah. Right. And that's how they, if they're shooting intravenously, that's how they die, because it's very, very powerful. It can suppress respirations. But I'm a little skeptical of this Prince story. I wanted to parse that out with you. They're saying that he had some bootleg Vicodin with fentanyl mixed in, which I don't doubt that was true. My question is, that doesn't explain the very high levels of fentanyl in his blood if he didn't know that he was ingesting fentanyl, because orally there's not sufficient absorption. So either he had to crush it and take it through his cheek, or there was some other source of fentanyl. Would you agree with that?
Well, I don't know the exact levels of fentanyl, but I have seen many people who were completely surprised that they were using fentanyl. Like, I've had people thought that they were using Xanax, and we drug test them, and it comes back positive for fentanyl. They're shocked. They're floored by it, and they develop tolerance.
No, but positive over time. But positive for fentanyl is one thing. In other words, it's in your mouth long enough to get some buccal absorption, as opposed to I'm taking so much fentanyl because I'm swallowing a bunch of Vicodin that's laced that it knocks me off my feet and I stop and I become have respiratory depression. I mean, that's a lot of fentanyl. It's really hard to get that much in, it seems to me, with a laced Vicodin.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm saying is, you know, although we're just speculating and who knows what was in Prince's mind, but what I see are incredibly high tolerances to fentanyl that you just don't see in hospital settings from people taking it for very long periods of time, either accidentally or purposefully. So I think I've seen it lots of different ways. I've seen some people become very, very tolerant on fentanyl even, and they can take dosages that would kill me outright or kill any person that's naive to it, and they can take it, and they're affected, of course, and they have overdoses from time to time. But I think it's hard to say one way or the other. I think, you know, the Prince story is a real tragedy because from Minnesota, he's kind of, you know, the state's son, and the whole state is very proud of him and out of the nation's mourning. But I think the state took a big hit with that, and it affected everybody tremendously.
Well,
and I hope
that
comes a pretty good story about, you know, again, stigma, that even people like Prince, that everybody kind of revered, can succumb to substance use.
Look, not only that is, don't get special care. If you have a substance problem, get care, get proper care, get standard care. He was 20 minutes away from a Hazleton treatment center, 20 minutes away. They could have thrown him in the car, take him to Hazleton, and that Prince would be sober and well today in all probability. And that's
incredible. Well, you know this a lot better than me, Dr. Drew. Yeah. I mean, because you treat individuals who have, you know, political, economic, or celebrity power, and they have their own gravity, and they bend reality around them, and they surround themselves with people that you know may not be healthy, but don't say no to them, and we see that all too often.
Well, my problem is that our profession complies with it, is duplicitous in it, and that makes me nuts. It makes me absolutely nuts. Because it is, you know, standard of care is the standard for a reason. It's the best. It's the best with the highest probability of a good outcome, least risk. You get special care, that's substandard care.
Well, that's a rich person care, special
substandard,
care.
Immediately.
Yeah, but it's I want to be told what
too
I want to hear.
Yep, substandard.
Right?
Yeah, that's not standard.
Okay, care. I think one of the great issues with Prince's death is that we don't view it as, look, this can happen to anybody. We just went, oh, no, he's dead. Like, most people don't go, wait, he was taking drugs and he died? Like, most people don't think that.
Really?
They understand it, but I don't go, oh, shoot, if Prince can die.
Look, fentanyl, I've been yelling about this since Heath Ledger.
Yeah, you're a doctor.
But I've been screaming about it. There's footage of me on Larry King going, listen to me, this is a tsunami, everybody.
A lot of young people don't think Heath Ledger drugs killed him. They think Heath Ledger just accidentally overdosed.
I know.
It's not I need to be careful what I'm doing because look at that.
Last thing, Dr. Lee, I want to get into is that I don't know if you've encountered this, but you were talking about the black market and the fentanyl powders and stuff. One of the big problems we're running into right now is diversion of Subutex Suboxone. 100% of our youth, younger patients are diverting and selling it. There's a gigantic black market out there.
What do you mean by that to a layman like me?
They're selling it to buy heroin.
They're taking their prescription drugs and selling it. Yeah. Okay.
And then they use the, then they use what remains to sort of get them detoxed intermittently.
Are you saying I should stop selling it?
Stop selling Subutex, please.
Stop selling it right
now. Are you seeing that? Are you seeing that in your practice?
It all depends on how you do it. I think there are a lot of people in the Suboxone industry that don't work with insurance companies and kind of have a cash only business. And one of the problems of these kinds of businesses is they don't have, again, the infrastructure to do urine drug screens or the kind of other therapeutic supports that are necessary. And so you see some prescribing going on that from a harm reduction standpoint can prevent overdoses. But there may not be a good tracking of where things are going. And so we do see diversion, but in our system, not very much, actually. Most people that divert and misuse are trying to get past withdrawal. So naive people people who are naive to opioids will misuse buprenorphine, and they can get a pretty good punch from it. But it tends to block itself over time, and tolerance builds. And so people who are heroin users or fentanyl users generally only use Suboxone on the streets to stave off withdrawal. So we don't see a booming economy with it. One thing that is going to happen, I think, in the next year is you're going to see some stories about a lot of young people being affected with Xanax. I think Xanax is heavily tainted with fentanyl. Mm. And the reason that young people are the target of Xanax is because it's so cheap. People, again, through the dark web or other sites, are buying it for a quarter a bar, and then they're selling it on the streets for $2 to $5 a bar. So it's pretty affordable even for high school kids. And I can't tell you the number of kids that are taking benzodiazepines, and then they kind of get on the fentanyl wagon that way accidentally. Some of them know that the stuff that they're using is cut with fentanyl, but are so hooked that they can't find another way out. So we're going to hear this evolve a lot. And historically in the country, we're kind of at a turning point where the black market economics with the fentanyl and the prescription drugs before that and heroin in between have really shifted. And I think decades later, we'll look back at this moment and see what kind of a watershed moment it is for lots of different issues.
Thank God our profession is finally getting the message and the prescribing rates are dropping way, way off.
Can I ask a dumb question real quick?
Very quick, then we got to
wrap it up. Fentanyl, people that are cutting Xanax with fentanyl, is that coming from the drug manufacturers? Is that
coming from
middlemen?
No,
that when they
China.
Yeah, most of it is amateur.
They talk about stuff.
It's you can buy pill presses online, and a lot of people are making the pill presses. Organized crime now is kind of bypassing the dark web and now just going and finding connections to these labs, and they're able to get things. And I don't know how they're making it.
I can't believe you just said that because
why?
Yeah, some of the people I see are using pill presses. Some people use powder. Mm-hmm. There's so many different ways to use fentanyl, and it's very discreet. We see people using it, and then we see a lot of people who don't think they're using fentanyl because they're scared of it because they hear the news and they think they're using something else. They think they're using MDMA. They think they're using cocaine. They think they're using, pain medications from a doctor's office. And so we see this all too common that they're fooled by some contaminant, and that contaminant ends up being fentanyl.
Kim, what'd you say?
Well, this is great to talk about all of this and to talk about Prince and everything else, but, you know, we really need to bring to light the kids that aren't getting helped that want to commit suicide to get away from this, Drew.
Oh, yeah.
And all of, I know everything that we're talking about is bringing, you know, to the forefront and educating, but what we're not talking about are those kids that are so desperate to lead that normal life again. But because of that 3 days of treatment that you're talking about, or that 1 week of treatment that they're talking about, it's like my friend Jonathan who says, I just pray to God I can get through to that kid in that 1 week to save his life or her life. And that's where we need to start going. I mean, these conversations all lead to the same place, saving these people and finding something that makes a difference.
Well, it's a complex issue.
It's incredibly complex.
And there's debate about how to do it. And Dr. Lee was kind of alluding to that.
Exactly.
And I think what Hazelden does, which is they use, you know, Suboxone where appropriate. They have multiple disciplines available,
exactly.
But it takes time and effort, and it's very labor intensive.
And it takes money.
But
exactly.
We're going to have to wrap it up.
Go ahead, Dr. Lee. I think we work with insurance companies, and not to vilify them, we purposely started to work with them. We are one of the first treatment centers of our kind to do so because we wanted to serve as many people as possible. And so it definitely is a dance with them. But I think the important part in the conversation is addiction is really about people and not drugs. When we start to vilify drugs only, or think about procedural medicine or focus on diagnoses, we lose the prioritization of people. And if we think about people as being high risk and helping them, even if they're sober, even if they're going through withdrawal, I think that would change the dialogue a lot. So instead of looking at just kind of what kind of condition they have acutely or whether they're acutely suicidal, looking at people longitudinally and making investments in those people so that they can get out of trouble and stay out of trouble.
I agree.
That's a big part of the conversation that I think is right now missing.
Nope, you said it, because I took my addiction when I quit drinking and moved it onto other stuff.
Yes.
That's it.
There you go. Yeah.
He's right. Yep. It's not, because no matter what, I'm going to find something to overdo it on.
It's a spiritual, physical, emotional, social,
trait,
so many things. All right, we got to wrap things up. Dr. Lee, thank you so much. I appreciate you being here, and thank you for all the work at Hazleton. I love you guys over there.
Great
and,
information.
Well, thank you for having us on.
You bet. Thank you so much. And then Kim, congratulations. Good
you.
Luck in the campaign.
Thanks.
I mean, this, even if this doesn't go, I feel like you're going to be out there doing stuff politically from now on, probably, right?
You know what, Drew? You know me for a long time. I put my mind to something, I'm going to make it happen.
All right. Well,
so
that's, and that. So, what do you want people to do? Give them specific direction, like people in your district.
You know what? Really important to get out there and vote.
Just vote.
Vote on the 5th. You know, if nothing else motivates you to get you to the polls, go to repeal the gas tax. That's the start in California. We need to show people in Sacramento the will of the people. And we're on a very slippery slope right now. This doesn't make the ballot. There's a lot more coming, ladies and gentlemen, and it's only getting worse.
There you go. So.
If I were you, I would have said, get out and vote and then go enjoy an avocado.
Well, go to KimberlandForCongress.com. I've got all the information there, all right?
Avocado sales, too, apparently.
And you know what? I'm going to put on a recipe for avocados now.
I love avocados.
All right, guys. Thank you so much. Oh, and we'll see you next time.
Remember, you can find all these podcasts at drdrew.com. The Dr. Drew podcast, the This Life podcast, and the Adam and Drew podcast, which is available 5 days a week. Find them all on iTunes and rate us 5 stars. Subscribe and get it first. And if you're really happy, click on the Amazon banner at drdrew.com to help support the show. We'll thank you for it. If you join the email list via drdrew.com/contact, we'll send you a weekly infusion newsletter with Dr. Drew's news. We're so grateful when you get in touch. We read all your emails and we'll bring you the subject matter you want to hear about.
You live.